And now, let's turn to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local officials, residents, and personalities providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer. Moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, once again, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Lance Ketterling, police chief for the city of Palmer.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. It's windy this morning.
It is windy. Yes, indeed.
And we're about to have rain come down, and as the weather report suggests, 100% chance of rain, up to about a half inch with wind and rain. Does that affect people's lives, do you think?
Well, it'll get wet.
Yeah, that is
true. But yes, it will indeed. So might just change some weekend plans or, you know, force people to continue with some more indoor activities, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay. But that doesn't change what the police department does, or does it?
Only as much as it might affect the plans of the people that are out there. But no, our mission's going to continue same as any other time of year.
What we would like to do today, perhaps, is sketch out, since we haven't talked about this in quite a while, when we refer to the police department, and there are officers that some listeners are familiar with because they see them on a regular basis, their paths cross one place or another. But could you just describe who are the people that make up the police department? How many? What do they do, et cetera?
Sure. Great question. Well, when you look at it in totality, there are 31 people that make up the Palmer Police Department. Now, that includes dispatchers, administrative staff, support staff, and, of course, reserve police officers. And so the breakdown is like this. What we call the sworn force, the police officer side of that equation, are 15 individuals. And of that 15 individuals, there's myself, the chief of police, and the patrol commander, who is basically responsible for patrol operations. And he supervises three police sergeants and the building custodian. And the building custodian, of course, maintains the facilities. And we have two patrol sergeants and one detective sergeant. And the detective sergeant is in charge of major cases, and he has a detective answering to him. And then the two patrol sergeants each supervise one of our shifts, day shifts or night shift. And the shifts go from 6 in the morning to 6 at night, and then from 6 at night to 6 in the morning. And at any given time, there's usually a minimum of two police officers working, including the patrol sergeants. And then sometimes there's up to three, and not including myself and the commander, who are more administrative than we are operational anymore. So those officers and the fire department as well are dispatched by the Palmer Police and Fire Dispatch Center, which makes there are seven total employees there, one dispatch supervisor and six emergency dispatchers, and they dispatch police and fire calls inside the Palmer city limits. And then we have three support staff, the aforementioned building custodian. We have an administrative assistant, and then we have an evidence and records clerk, tech, who runs the evidence room and fills records requests, public information requests, that sort of thing. And then we also have six reserve police officers who are volunteers that come in. They are basically indistinguishable between regular police officers, but for the fact that they are not sworn, they are not APSC certified. Their badge says reserve on it rather than patrol officer. And they are not technically employees of the city. They are volunteers that come in and donate their time to kind of give back to the community out of a sense of community. And that rounds up the force, total of 31 people at the moment.
Whoa. Okay. That's a comprehensive look at the numbers. I'm guessing that since I've seen occasionally some new faces, that there is a turnover. People get older, they may retire, they may move on to something else, they
sure.
move up, down, around, et cetera. What kind of description can you give of how that force of 31 changes or has changed over the last few years? Big changes, few changes?
Well, going back to when I started here in 1970, 1997, the police force, in terms of turnover, the rate of turnover really waxes and wanes due to a number of different factors. And part of that starts with the selection process when we pick people that we really hope and believe are going to be a good fit for the organization. In other words, they're going to like us and we're going to like them and they can become part of the family and be happy here. And stay for longer periods of time. And then there are things like injuries. People will just and with newer officers, it's more often the case that they will – if you're going to lose them due to not liking the career, in other words, they don't particularly – the police work wasn't what they thought it was. They'd like to do something else. That typically happens within a – normally within the first 5 years of them starting their job. They get it. They get through the academy. They get through their field training, and that's a year right there. And then, you know, a couple of years into it, it's, wow, the shift work is very, very difficult, or I didn't think it was going to be this way. And so they wind up moving on. And again, a lot of that is based on selection, and a lot of it is based on just the individual personalities and tendencies of the officers that we hire. So it goes up and down. Right now, we are technically at full strength, which is good, and we hope to stay that way for a significant period of time. 3 years or so ago, we started going through something of a turnover process, and it can take a while to work through that where you develop some stability in the department simply because we do have those new officers that have no experience, and they're more inclined to either A, not complete the training cycle, which they're required to do in order to work by themselves, to work full time, or they just decide this really isn't for me. Mm-hmm. So, and then there's occasions where we have people that, for whatever reason, they'll move out of state, they'll just, you know, be leaving Alaska. We do lose some to other organizations at times, troopers, you know, other agencies around the state, APD, Wasilla, that sort of thing has happened in the past. Although that has curtailed to a great degree over the last few years. And retirement, of course. People, you know, patrol is typically a younger person's game. I mean, it can be a very active, very dynamic type of job for a long period of time. And you don't see as many people in their 50s or nearing retirement age that enjoy that type of work anymore.
So two things about this. One, 12-hour shifts.
12s at the moment, yes.
Whoa. So is that 3 12s or how's that work?
It's 3 12s 1 week and 4 12s the next in the pay period. And then on their fourth 12-hour day, we try to make that an 8. And so they can basically take a short day on that to round out their 80 hours that they need to complete the pay period. So
one of the things I know in some lines of work could be medical field, it could be pilots and so on.
Sure.
There's a thing called on-call.
Mm-hmm.
Does that happen here as well?
Well, we have two on-call officers who, it's a good point, I forgot to add them, and we give them a shout when we're low on staffing. In other words, we have people injured, we have people in training, mm-hmm. The fair is coming up, and they come in and help. And so they will be able to put on a uniform and come pick up a couple of shifts. Now, there's that type of on-call.
Right.
And then there's also the type of on-call where we have a potential major event coming up and we need you to stand by the phone and be available for response. Two very different kinds of things. And so we don't engage in the latter all that much. It is sometimes there. But that would happen if we have an officer that may be going to training, if we're not sure he's going to make it in, someone that is out sick and anticipates being back on a particular day, but maybe they don't make it, so we put somebody on call. We have something like colony days where typically, and this usually involves myself or the commander, where we'll just make sure that we might necessarily be in the office, but we're definitely around town and available to come in should something happen and we need to respond for something major.
So I'm thinking also of the acute event where you have an incident, a situation. Are there other officers available to be brought in for some incident or something of that sort? Or does that not happen?
So are you referring to something like a mutual aid agreement with other agencies?
I'm trying to come up with what might be a typical other event. some kind of
Well, the big thing is it a planned event? In other words, is it an
unplanned.
Expected
Let's
event
say,
or is it an unplanned emergency?
Right.
And
the latter.
So in the event of unplanned emergencies, the officers are subject to be called in basically whenever.
Okay.
Now, they have to determine their fitness for duty. In other words, if the officer has been out to dinner and has had a couple glasses of beer or a couple glasses of wine, then they're not eligible to come in and assist with that event simply because they're not fit for duty at that particular point. If they haven't had any sleep in the past 24 hours because they've been on their days off and they've been out on the river trying to catch fish, then maybe them coming in to try to do. But in the event of a major emergency, as you've just kind of heard, Palmer's numbers are not all that great, and major emergencies can absorb resources at an incredible rate. And so, yes, we're probably going to pull the chain on everybody we can get in. And that's something they understand, and it's something we communicate to them very, very early on in their time with us. And it's not unusual for agencies of our size or even very large agencies to have a very similar policy in place.
Okay, so let's talk about something that has been in the news lately. It's kind of an interesting thing, and that involves what has been the potential for having the Palmer Service, which seems to have this piece of Palmer, mm-hmm. the city, down well. The question about the Palmer Police Service being extended to other areas, not just in a mutual aid, but to provide service. Same discussions have occurred with Wasilla in areas of the borough which may be underserved by police services. Any continuing discussion on about that?
Not at a level that has reached myself. Now, we did a feasibility study for this. You're probably referring to that. That was at the council
right.
Several months back. And that was done at basically the behest of the city manager because we wanted to know what it would look like if Palmer elected to offer these services someplace else. It's not because we'd been asked to. It's not because we had plans to do it. But a little bit of what would this look like? And the impetus was that the borough in particular – and also local residents had expressed some concerns about staffing levels for law enforcement in their particular area. And so the question was asked, what would it look like? How much would it cost roughly were Palmer to do this? And the real answer to that question, it's a matter of how many and how much. You know, how many officers do you need? How many people do they need to provide service for? How much geographical area do they need to cover? And so the staffing is going to be predicated by that, among other things. Staffing studies can get fairly complicated, but you look at geography, you look at numbers of populations, you get any type of call and crime data you can for the area you're talking about staffing, and you throw that all together and look at several different things and come up with a rough number. There's no substitute for actually doing the job in a particular area for a particular time to know what numbers you need. You can estimate, and sometimes it's a very close estimate. You can best guess it. But until you've actually provided service for a particular area, it can be difficult to know precisely how many folks you need for that. So there have been no discussions with me at my level mm-hmm. regarding this since that time. Not meaningful ones anyway in terms of will you do this. That has not been asked of us.
Okay.
It was an informational study at the time.
Okay. So the other thing that we have, whenever you've come in, taken a look at is the technology of whether it's cameras, computer systems, communication systems, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to ask that question today with the focus on have there appeared recently new technologies or are there some on the horizon that are going to affect the way in which the police officer does his or her job?
The short answer is there are incremental steps that take place pretty much all the time, whether it's recording equipment, video equipment, communications equipment, conductive energy weapons like tasers, that sorts of things, tools in the officers' toolboxes, tools for the dispatchers to use, things like 911 texting instead of having to call in, mapping, will that get better, call location, that sort of thing. These are evolutionary steps, typically, rather than revolutionary steps. In other words, you look at what's typically existing, and some company or vendor or somebody out there will figure out a way to maybe improve upon it or make it a little bit better. But in terms of something revolutionary, in other words, that's a game changer for law enforcement based on technology, mm-hmm. We're not seeing that all that much. Some people might have considered body cameras to be something akin to that. But the reality is officers had been recording either with digital pocket recorders or on their dash cams for years before body cams came out and were in widespread use. And it's important to remember that body cams, I don't know if you would consider them in widespread use or not. Certainly in Alaska, I don't think you might. We use them and we've had great success with them. We think they're a wonderful tool. But not every organization might think the same thing. It's an individual choice that they need to make as a group. What we find with technology is that, one, it can be extremely expensive to implement, and radios are a great example of that.
Right.
And the other is that it needs to be tested both technically, in other words, does this equipment work? Does it do what it's supposed to? And then it needs to be tested constitutionally. In other words, just because this equipment exists, is it something that we as law enforcement can use? And if so, how can we use it? A great example of what's going on with that now are unmanned aerial vehicles or drones, sure. or whatever you right. want to call them. Before that, it was thermal imaging. You know, can you point a thermal imager at a residence in order to detect a heat signature to potentially find, at the time when it was illegal, a marijuana grow or perhaps a meth lab? And the answer from the courts was no, not without a warrant. You can't. And so does the technology work the way it's supposed to, and can you use it? And those are really important questions that need to be answered. So it's always a moving target. There's best practices, and then there's what departments can afford. So it's just something that you need to try to keep up with as best as you can so you can make good cases.
So you mentioned two things. So the first thing is cameras, body cams, mm-hmm. but also seem to remember that the city is has been working on having cameras, CCTV type cameras yep. around the city. How's that progressing?
Well, it's a pilot program, and the city manager is working on that at the moment. And so the questions we're trying to answer now is where we're going to put these, and how will we get the feed from the camera back to a place where that will be monitored? And that's most likely going to be dispatch. And those questions are being answered right now. And of course, we also have to look at the legal question is where is there a reasonable expectation of privacy, and to make sure that any type of monitoring equipment is not potentially set up to invade that expectation of privacy, because that's extremely important to us.
And, of course, we're talking about a city-owned system versus, obviously, businesses which have their own systems.
Quite a few businesses around town have those. And for what it's worth, most of them have been very willing to work with and assist the police department in the apprehension of offenders with their video footage. So, and that's been a great help.
So recently, there has been discussion, particularly in Anchorage, about increasing the tax on marijuana sales. And we know that the city of Palmer is a marijuana-free zone in terms of retail, wholesale distribution. Have there been any issues associated with marijuana now? There's been a change in the rules, if you will, in Palmer itself, or is marijuana as a problem requiring police attention not been a high-level issue?
The short answer is there has not been a great change in terms of marijuana being an issue in Palmer any more than there had been for the 5 or 10 years or so before that law was passed. It's simply something that, one, it had been around in profusion before it was legal for a considerable period of time. And two, we have not been responding to exponential number of marijuana calls since the law was passed. We don't know of any commercial retail establishments in town, so they're abiding by that by that decision by the city council or by the voters. And there's no retail establishments, commercial establishments. We're not getting calls about major illegal grows or grow operations. Of course, the small ones are legal now. I don't have the data in front of me, but anecdotally, it doesn't sound like calls have picked up a great deal at Palmer High and Palmer Junior Middle, although I have heard from other administrators that they have picked up in other areas. I don't have data in front of me to support or deny that at the point.
But basically, the law changed and not much changed in Palmer.
Not a great deal. Okay. I think that's a fair assessment, yeah.
Okay, good. Another issue that our neighbor, large neighbor to the south, has been dealing with is homelessness, homeless camps, so on. Is that an issue in Palmer?
It is indeed. Yes, very much so.
And describe how the police deal with that, because I know that's been one of the issues. How is that dealt with?
Oh, boy. Well, that's a tricky one. I mean, historically, police have difficulty dealing with a homeless population because homelessness is first and foremost a socioeconomic issue. It's a social issue that the police generally are not equipped to deal with much. We can enforce when an ordinance is violated, when a law is violated, but being homeless is not illegal. And so the thing to remember is that it's more often than not, much more often than not, it's not simply that somebody doesn't have a place to live. Often it's not. There are heavy mental illness diagnoses that come along with homelessness. Sometimes there's a great deal of substance abuse that comes along with homelessness. And then there are all the subsequent criminal activity that can accompany those types of things. Minor thefts, assaults, burglaries, trespassing, those kinds of things are some of the more common ones that we deal with. And when the officers encounter those, they certainly act on them as appropriate. So the trick, when what we're trying to do is figure out a way to solve the problem rather than treat the symptom, because a trip to the hospital, a trip to Matsui pretrial, that will do something on a strictly temporary basis for a short period of time. What they need in terms of combating homelessness, basically you need a few things. You need temporary housing, you need employment, you need education, and you need transportation. And if you can complete that equation, and it's a very difficult equation to complete, then you can start to help people pull out of this kind of thing. But transitional housing, education, employment, and transportation, you've got to be able to get to your job. You've got to be able to obtain a job and keep that job. And you've got to have a place to live while you're doing it until you can get back on your feet. Those are four things that are pretty critical. And the police department is just simply not equipped to provide many of those at all, with the possible exception of some type of education in terms of putting people in touch with services. So that's what we try to do. We have a resource list that we can give out to these individuals. We're working with the high user group MATSU, it's also called HUMS, Crisis Intervention Team. All the officers now attend mental health first aid training, and some of them are go through the 40-hour CIT Academy to help them deal with people that are in mental health crisis. But it's getting these people in touch with the services, and I'll say the limited services that are available to them in the Valley, in order to help them with their mental health challenges if they have them, help them with their substance abuse problems if they're challenges, what might be the underlying cause of this homelessness issue, and putting them in touch with the professionals that can actually do some good.
Now, in Anchorage, there's been a discovery of homeless camps in areas and population is much larger there, et cetera. Does Palmer face with that same kind of thing on a smaller scale at all?
On a smaller scale, yes. And what we find is they're very transient. There are some locations around town that are known to us that we tend to check on a regular basis just to make sure a camp is not springing up there.
Okay.
And then it basically gets moved someplace else. These individuals are by nature somewhat transient in terms of their living conditions. And so if they move out of one stand of trees to perhaps another stand of trees or another place where they can get some temporary shelter, then sometimes it's identified. And sometimes it's an okay place for them to camp, and sometimes it's not. So camping is not allowed in city parks. And so most people don't want it on their private property. And so they wind up calling us. So, and then there's a great deal of concern with residents and vendors at the presence of one of these things in near their property someplace, because of some of the challenges that come with that.
Okay. So. Well, Mike Malefsky, I've been talking with Police Chief Lance Cutterling of Palmer Police Department, and we've covered a lot of ground here, talking about 31 different people working for the police department and on to other relevant topics. We've just got a minute or so left here. Any last comments you'd like to share with the listening audience?
No, not at the moment.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming in today.
Sure.
We certainly enjoyed it. And we look forward to another visit 6 weeks or so down the road.
You've been listening to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local folks providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer. Moderated by Mike Malefsky. This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions, please email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.